The five books of the Torah have Greek names: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Well, not quite Greek. Numbers. I don't think. Well, and Deuteronomy, right? The five books. And people think that those are kind of like Greek or Latin or some sort of name. But in fact, it's actually based on names that were given much earlier sources, because earlier Torah commentators talk about Genesis means the beginning of the creation, the beginning of the process. And it's known as Sefer HaYetzirah, the book of formation. Okay. The book of Shemos is known as the book of Exodus. In Hebrew, it's called Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption. Okay. The third book of the Torah, Vayikra, which focuses largely on laws of the temple, the Mishkan, the service, and the laws of the priests and so on, of the Kohanim, is called Leviticus, which means, Leviticus. Well, Vayikra is the first word of the book, which means, and he called. But Leviticus has, don't ask me for the exact translation, but it has something to do with Levites. Okay, the tribe of Levi. Because the tribe of Levi are the ones who did the work in the Mishkan. And in fact, there's a medrash called Toras Kohanim on that book, which means the laws of the priests. So it's tied in. The book of Bamidbar is called Numbers. It's called Sefer HaPekudim, which means the book of Numbers. And the last book, Devarim, is called Mishnah Torah, which means the repetition of the Torah. There's a lot of repetition of many other parts of the Torah in the book of Devarim. A lot of discussion why things are repeated. It's not for our discussion now, but it's called Deuteronomy. Again, don't ask me the exact, but Deuteronomy means, do means two or twice. So it is the second time around, so to speak. So it's interesting to know that those names actually have Torah sources. It's not just, some scholar decided to give those names to it. So I just, as a way of introduction to this book, I want to just focus on an interesting question. And we'll spend a couple minutes on this question and the answer. And that is, why is the book called the Book of Redemption if only the first four sections, the first four parshios of the entire book focus on the exile and the redemption? If you think about it, you have Shemos Va'erev Bo B'Shalach, talks about this week, talks about the exile and the birth of Moshe and the early attempts at freedom for the Jewish people. Next week focuses on the plagues. Parshas Bo, the third parsha, is the last three plagues and the actual Exodus. And B'Shalach, the fourth parsha, is the splitting of the sea. And that's it. We're done with Egypt at that point. The rest of the book is the giving of the Torah, is the Mishpatim, is laws, is the golden calf, is the construction of the tabernacle. So barely a third of the book, not even half, focuses on Exodus. And yet the whole book is called Exodus. Why? So the Ramban, Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, the great 13th, yes, I believe so. Excuse me, still there a little bit. The great 13th century commentator, in his commentary on the Torah, he says as follows. He says that the process of exile and subsequent redemption did not end with going out of Egypt and the splitting of the sea and the destruction of the Egyptians. It did not end with that. Okay, because, and I'm going to expand on his idea a little bit over here. I'm going to expand a bit. I'll just say what he says and I'll expand on it. He says the Jewish people were not truly fully freed from Egypt until they reattained the same spiritual state or reality that the patriarchs had attained before Jacob and his family went down to Egypt. Okay, we talked about last week the idea that Jacob, Yaakov, and the tribes going into Egypt, that was the beginning of the exile. They left the land of Canaan, they went down into Egypt, and now they were going to be in exile. Hang on a second. Okay? And so, says the Ramban, freedom did not just mean leaving the land of Egypt. It meant reattaining the stature, the reality that had existed before the Jewish people, the young Jewish people, the family, Yaakov and his children and his family, went down to Egypt, which was living with God in their midst. Yaakov lived with God as part of his life. The Shekhinah, the divine presence of God, was with Yaakov. And so just leaving Egypt wasn't enough. Even the giving of the Torah wasn't enough. Until they built that tabernacle, which was a forerunner of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash, okay? And God dwelled within, among the Jewish people. They had not reattained the stature of their forefathers, of the patriarchs, until that point. And at that point was the true culmination and end of the process of going out of Egypt. They had to get back and grow back to that spiritual state. And that only happened after the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was erected, was built. And if you look at the end of the book of Exodus, of Shemos, it says all the way at the end that this is what happened. The Shekhinah resided in the Mishkan. Chazak, chazak, v'nischazek. Now we just jumped ahead like 2.5 months. But, that is the process. And so when we go through the book of Shemos, we're not just watching a people go into slavery and then come out to freedom. We are watching a people go through a process of, so to speak, and I'm trying to expand on this a little bit, of rebirth, of to reattain not just freedom, but the spiritual stature that their forefathers had attained in their time. Yeah, go ahead.
So my question was, and I think you partly answered it, but was God not among them when the Lord of fire, the clouds, when they're coming through, and
Right. Okay. That's a very fair point. So I think the answer is that those pillars were, so to speak, God's emissaries or agents to lead them. But in terms of having a connection with God, a direct personal connection, having God, so to speak, live among them in a relationship-based way, that only happened with the creation of the Mishkan. And in fact, Hashem tells Moshe, again, I'm jumping ahead about a month and a half here in Parashas Truma, the Asuli Mikdash, they shall make for me a sanctuary, Vishachanti Bisocham, and I will dwell among them. You just said there's pillars, right? Those pillars are God's agents, so to speak. I think.
But what about every morning you're picking up on?
You're right. No, yeah, so God, yeah, so God's, you're right. God's the interaction is there. But I think, again, there's always levels and levels, but you can't compare, someone sending you food every day, or even, giving you a light to guide you. A GPS, a full service GPS, so to speak. They haven't come out with that yet. A GPS that that actually protects you from all the hazards of the roads and so on and so forth. But that is God again sending to the Jewish people, and of course a very strong level of interaction. But they're not actually, so to speak, living together.
So they're not living together
until there's a Mishkan. That's right.
Wow.
There are sources that say, this is a point of disagreement, that had they not made the golden calf, they wouldn't have needed a Mishkan. Okay? It's because they fell off that level that they can no longer relate directly. They needed a structure through which to relate to God, to have that relationship.
The guys. Huh? The men needed that.
To what?
The men needed that.
The men needed that. Okay, yes. Yeah.
So wasn't the splitting of the sea all God?
Yes. But that was temporary. That was a temporary flash of brilliance, of revelation of God. Yes, it's clear you are correct. By the splitting of the sea.
Could you repeat the question?
What? Yes, I'm sorry. Bob wants to know, wasn't God with them by the splitting of the sea? Wasn't that God himself directly splitting the sea? Okay, so the answer is yes. Sources say that the splitting of the sea, the Jewish people reached an enormous level of prophecy, unmatched by future prophets, save Moshe himself. But that was a temporary, if you will, flash of light. It faded, and then they had to go through the work of getting there themselves, which maybe we will talk about over there when we get there, what the splitting of the sea was versus, let's say, the giving of the Torah. How do those two measure up with each other? Two great revelations of God, but very different experiences. Okay, so that's a topic unto itself.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So, any questions from Zoom? Okay, we'll move on then. So I want to focus on this idea a little bit more about the exile and the process of the Jewish people in Egypt and so on, having given that introduction about the book of Exodus, about this process of going through the exile and in a, on a deeper level, how it measures up with their relationship with the patriarchs and so on and so forth. Okay, because you have a young, nascent Jewish nation going into Egypt. Everything seems to be wonderful. Joseph is the ruler of Egypt. Everything seems great. You've got a family of 70 people. God tells Jacob, I'll take care of you in Egypt. I'll be with you and so on and so forth. I will take you down. I will take you back out. That's God's promise. And everything seems wonderful. But then at the beginning of this week's parasha, things go downhill quickly after the death of all the tribes. So after all of the 12 tribes pass away, the Torah tells us that things go downhill rather quickly. The Jewish people are very successful in their new land of Egypt. And the Torah tells us that the Egyptians soon get sick of the Jewish people. And by the way, unfortunately, historically, this has repeated itself throughout Jewish history of exile. You see that the Jewish people will go into a land in exile, and then they will slowly, they'll be downtrodden and so on. They'll build themselves up. They'll become successful. And then what happens after they become successful is the host nation will start to become envious, will start to become resentful. And then that's where things start to unravel. Okay. And it's always a good idea to keep a low profile. That's not to say you shouldn't stand up for your needs and your rights and so on, but to keep a low profile, not to be overly ostentatious about positions of power or wealth or success or so on. In exile, it's always a good idea because usually, as the Torah says, the Jewish people multiplied and they were successful and so on. And then it says the Egyptians kind of got fed up with these Jewish people and they began to enslave them. That unfortunately is the process that has occurred over and over again, historically, many times. So that's just a tangential lesson. But what I want to focus on over here is a fascinating passage from Maimonides, from the Rambam, about the Jewish people. And that is this. Maimonides says that the Jewish people in Egypt, and some of you may have heard this idea before, had become very assimilated into Egyptian society, very much assimilated into Egyptian society. And they became so assimilated, and it's clear from many Midrashic sources that they were worshiping the idols of the Egyptians. Okay, they had become very assimilated into Egyptian society. Many Jews stopped circumcising their children because they didn't want to be different from the surrounding Egyptian culture. There was not intermarriage. There was one exception of a woman who was assaulted by her by an Egyptian, and she had a child who was known as the son of the Egyptian man, who later curses the name of God. He blasphemes God's name. And it's recorded that he is the only recorded instance of where she was a little too loose, shall we say, with the Egyptian taskmasters and so on. And she caught the eye of one of them. And he ended up attacking her, and she had a child from him. But there are sources that say that Joseph's moral strength that he displayed in his process created the spiritual power for the Jewish people to withstand that issue of intermarriage. Intermarriage did not occur in this case in Egypt. Okay. But in terms of idolatry, they were very much into the idol worship of Egypt and so on and so forth. The Rambam says that the Jewish people were so assimilated into Egyptian society that they almost lost their connection to the patriarchs. He said it was this close. It was just about destroyed. Okay, there are sources that say that the Jewish people were taken out of Egypt by God in the nick of time. Had they remained a moment later, they would have been completely lost into Egyptian society. In other words, what that means is, what Maimonides is saying, is that the spiritual connection the Jewish people had to their origins, the patriarchs, had become so tenuous, had become so frayed, that had they remained for a moment later, it would have been lost. So you would have had a nation. Maybe they would have had a national identity of some sort. But in terms of spiritual connection to the origins of the patriarchs, of their forefathers, in terms of spiritual connection, would have been completely lost. And they had to be pulled out of there at the last moment in order to prevent them from losing that connection.
Okay. Rabbi.
So that is what, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, what makes the Jewish religion so weak that they lose all this that they had?
That is a very good point. I will try to address that momentarily. Okay, I will repeat the question. Yes, the question that Ethel on the phone in Arizona is asking is that why was the Jewish religion so weak that they would have completely lost that? So I will address that. Soon, very, very, you're asking a very good question, and there's a very fascinating answer to that question. I will get to it shortly. Okay, any other questions before I go on? Okay, easy audience today. So far, the day is yet young. So here's the idea. And the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, great 17th century Kabbalist, he makes the following point. He says the following idea. He says the following idea. He says that, everyone okay? We're good? Okay. He says that the patriarchs, and we've discussed this idea in the past under different contexts, are like the roots, the foundation. But he says they are the roots. The patriarchs, on an individual level, as individuals, achieved great spiritual heights. They and the 12 tribes, they achieved enormous spiritual heights. They created a spiritual structure and a spiritual reality of a Jewish people. Okay? But they were individuals. And they laid the foundations. They created the roots of the Jewish people. Says Rabbi Luzzatto that from those roots had to grow forth now a tree. That tree will be the nation of the Jewish people. Okay? And that tree grows from the roots. If you have strong roots, you have a wonderful tree. And the process that the roots went through, the tree would go through as well on a much larger level because you have roots. The roots are, I know that when you have a fully grown tree, the roots are just as large underground as the tree above ground. Okay, if you, this is very parenthetical, but if you want to water a tree, where's the best place to water a tree? Anyone? What? At the roots, but where? Which spot do you choose? The outside perimeter, what they call the drip line. Okay, as far as the branches expand, that's generally how far the roots expand. And so you want the roots to keep reaching for more and more water, so you water it around the outer perimeter of the branches. Okay, that's that, unless you, of course, heavily prune back the tree. But in general, what they call the drip line, where the rain drips off the edges of the branches, that is where you want to water a tree. That's totally parenthetical. Relevant to our discussion is that the patriarchs are the roots. Those roots now had to go into Egypt and produce a tree. That tree would be the nation, the Jewish nation. What began as a movement of a few individuals who reconnected the world with God. Because if you look at the Torah, the world was full of idolatry. Monotheism did not really exist until Abraham showed up on the scene. And Avram is the one who reintroduced monotheism to the world and began this process of bringing God back into the world. All right, and he did it. Yitzchak, his son Isaac, continued that process. Jacob continued that process. And then the 12 tribes completed the process of creating the root system of a world where God can have a place, can reside, can manifest his presence in the world, so to speak. Okay, but that's all roots. Those are a bunch of individuals. 70 individuals go down to Egypt. They're not really a nation. They are a family. There are a group of 70 individuals who are going into Egypt. What's going to come out? A nation 600,000 strong, eventually, right? Now, by the way, when we talk about that 600,000 Jews left Egypt, it was a lot more. 600,000 are males between the age of 20 and 60. So if you do the math and you do a rough estimate, just a basic, you end up, commentators make, you know, on a minimum, you're talking about a nation of about 3 million people. Because 600,000 is just males between age 20 and 60. So if you take all the women into account, all the children into account, under 20, all the older people who are above 60 into account, you end up with a much larger group than just 600,000. That is, says Ramchal, that is the tree. That tree needs to grow and thrive and survive in Egypt. But if the tree gets cut off from the roots, it's dead. It doesn't have anything. It can't grow. It can't flourish. It can't succeed. So they need to maintain that connection to the roots. Okay. The challenge, one of the many challenges of Egypt, was for this tree to grow under conditions that were less than positive. And by maintaining that connection to the roots, to the original source, they would be able to grow forth and become a great nation. But if they would fail, if they would lose that connection, they wouldn't be able to continue. So they had to maintain, they had to somehow maintain that connection to their roots. A question? Your question? Yeah, Marcia, go ahead. So the Talmud says that 4/5 of the Jewish nation actually did not make it out of Egypt. And the idea over there is this precise point. 4/5 had lost their connection. And, you know, it says, the Talmud says they didn't want to leave Egypt. Who doesn't want to leave Egypt? Imagine if you come, God forbid, someone who went through the Holocaust, and you say, would you like to leave Germany now? No, I'd much rather stay here. You know, I'd much rather stay in this camp over here. I mean, who would say that?
I have a comment.
Hang on one second. That's okay. You can make the argument if that's all you know. That's a fair point. Yeah, what was that? Mrs. Frieder, you wanted to say something?
It just occurred to me that maybe might have been because when people... Are you hearing me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, when people share a common sorrow, there's a very strong bond that occurs. So the slavery may have resulted in the helping to create the nation.
I mean, it did. It's clear in the Torah that you are correct, that it's clear that the slavery did help create the nation. So therefore what? Therefore they wanted to stay in Egypt?
No, I'm saying specifically not just the slavery, but the aspect of the slavery being the bond that's created when people share a powerful experience.
Yes, you are
particularly
correct.
Particularly a negative one.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. That national identity, and in fact, it's not my discussion today, why they had to go through that slavery. That's not my conversation today. That needs its own very lengthy discussion. But you are correct that one
not
of the
identity, ideas, bond.
Yes,
bond,
that,
like
that the bonds created, you are died. Correct. The bonds created between
the young lady who just died in Israel, and we're feeling it in a mutual sharing of sorrow and empathy all the way over here.
Yeah. Yes, that is absolutely true. Yes, it's absolutely true. Ms. Spirit points out that the bond that is shared by the Jewish people throughout the world, if a tragedy happens to a Jewish person in Israel or anywhere else in the world, right, we all feel that. We feel that pain, and those bonds were created because of that shared experience of slavery. And in fact, sources say it wasn't just the shared experience, but that in general, they looked out for each other. Okay, and that was part of the merit that enabled them to leave, was that they looked out for each other even under those terrible conditions in slavery. So, having said all this, that the Jews will have to go down to Egypt. They have to survive, and if they survive, they will thrive. The Torah says the more the Egyptians oppress them, the more they proliferate, the more they multiply, the more they grow. Okay, and this again has been the history of the Jewish people throughout history, that when they are oppressed that their greatest successes tend to follow. Okay, you talk about what has happened to the Jewish people, for example, post-Holocaust, in recent history. Many people wrote off the Jewish people for dead after the Holocaust, and thank God there has been a remarkable resurgence on so many fronts for the Jewish people. Hashem should continue to watch over us and protect us and everyone in the world. But Ethel wanted to know why, Ethel on the phone, not you, Ethel in Arizona wanted to know why is it that they had such a hard time keeping their heads above water and avoiding assimilation. Why indeed did that happen? So there's a very, very interesting, that's a very interesting question. And I will share with you an answer based on a fascinating question that was asked to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was the preeminent halachic authority of the past generation. He passed away in 1986. And he was asked the following question. He was asked, is it problematic for a Jew to go by a non-Jewish name, we'll call it, or a more anglicized, or in the case of Europe, a more European name. Okay, is that a problem? Why is this problematic? Because the Medrash says that the Jewish people in Egypt, the reason why they merited to leave Egypt was they did not change their language, their mode of dress, or their names. They kept those three things intact. So seemingly, keeping a Jewish name is a very important part of being able to maintain your identity. That was the merit that got them out. Okay. Yet here we are today. We speak English. We don't speak Hebrew. Yiddish is a whole discussion unto itself I'm not getting into today. Yiddish is a corrupted version of medieval German. And depending on which part of Europe you later came from, you have a lot of Russian or Polish or, words from whichever country your family came from. For example, Lakshin, which everyone thinks is a Yiddish word, is not German in the slightest. It is, I think, Polish, if I'm not mistaken. Anyways, just as an example. Yes, I'm sorry, you are correct. Ladino for the Spanish Jews was Yiddish for the, you are correct.
But a lot of Jews from Spain originally who went to other countries were on the Silk Road.
Went around the whole world. So it is interesting. Marcia points out, I said Yiddish and I forgot Ladino. Ladino is far less common today, very uncommon. There are still a few pockets, but very, huh? I love people who speak it. There are people trying to preserve Ladino. Ladino, for those not familiar, is basically the Spanish Yiddish. It was a corrupted version of medieval Spanish, but probably a combination of the expulsion from Spain and the subsequent wanderings of the Jews and so on have decimated it, whereas Yiddish was around until the Holocaust, and many communities today, especially in the Hasidic world, continue to speak it. And in fact, for many of them, it's their main language in the home. So Yiddish is widely spoken in those communities. But I don't want to get too much off onto that path. But go ahead. I'm trying to get back to. So go ahead. Yeah. Yes.
So it's language, dress, and
names. Okay. If you think about it, I'm sorry. So let me get back. So this was the question asked to Rabbi Feinstein, and part of the reason he was asked was because some of the great Torah authorities in Hungary in the late 1800s, the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, who was regarded as the father of modern Hungarian Jewry. Okay. Today there's not a whole lot of Jews left in Hungary, but he created a model for a community that was uniquely Hungarian, that was unique to Hungary, to Hungarian Jewry, and his students, his children, and so on, who were very strong against the movements that sought to abandon traditional Jewry. So one of the big fights they had was not to drop using a Jewish name. They spoke very strongly against it. One of the reasons they did so was because they viewed in that era when a lot of Jews were abandoning their heritage, one of the things that they tried to change was usage of Jewish names. So consequently, in Germany, even among the Orthodox communities in Germany, almost everyone in Germany, even very Orthodox communities, they went by a German name. Okay, for those who are familiar today, in the founder of Beth Jacob and the Kollel, Rabbi Meyer Schwab, some of you are familiar with the name, okay? He goes by the name Meyer, which is a anglicized version, but his Hebrew name is Meyer. Right, Meyer is a anglicized, or I don't know if you want to say Germanized or anglicized version of the name. And he always writes his name as Meyer, but he pronounces it Meyer. So in speech it's Meyer, but in writing it's Meyer. I believe that's a holdover from his father fled from Germany. He fled Hitler, and that's I think a holdover from that German Orthodox community. Okay, so Rabbi Feinstein was asked this question. Is it important? Can one go by a more, we'll call, secular name? Can you go by David or Joseph or Jacob or Jack, whatever you prefer, or Abe? Do you have to go by your actual Hebrew name? So Rabbi Feinstein said, you don't have to go by a Hebrew name. Of course, it's nicer to do so, but you don't have to. Ah, but the Medrash says that the Jewish people maintained their name and their language. Says Rabbi Feinstein, a fascinating insight. And Ethel, this will answer your question finally. Says Rabbi Feinstein, that was before the Jewish people got the Torah. But after they left Egypt, they got the Torah. The Torah is what ties them to their tradition, to their heritage, to God, to the patriarchs. And therefore, it's not necessary to use those other modes to keep their identity. So while they were in Egypt, they had to maintain a connection to the patriarchs, to their origins, through language, name, and mode of dress, because they didn't have a Torah yet. They had a handful of mitzvos they knew about. They had circumcision. They had a few other things that they were aware of, handed down. But they didn't have a formal system of Torah, of God's commandments to the Jewish people. That didn't exist. That did not exist. So what was going to tie them to their tradition? They had to keep some sort of identity. So name, language, and mode of dress is what kept them. Okay? Now, that is a very challenging way of keeping, maintaining your connection, because how long will it take until they become thoroughly Egyptian, even with the language and the mode of dress and so on? The challenge they faced in Egypt was keep some sort of connection. something to fall back on, some connection to those roots, so that when you go out of Egypt, you're still connected. That tree could still survive because it's still connected to those roots that they started from. So that connection was name, motive, dress, and language. Think about it for a minute. If you think about it for a minute, you will see name, dress, and language are the three areas of a person. If we could divide our experiences with ourselves and the world around us, you will see that our name, a person's name, is very, very important. The Talmud says that giving someone a pejorative nickname is a serious offense. It's a terrible thing to do, to give someone a pejorative nickname. Even a regular nickname, which is not insulting, is best avoided. I don't mean calling someone, you know, like Yankee instead of Yaakov, or, you know, Malki instead of Malka, or whatever. I mean, like, you know, calling Shorty for sure is a problem, Shorty, etc. You know, to give someone a pejorative nickname is for sure a problem, which, by the way, totally tangential, reminds me. What do you call someone who puts his right arm down a lion's throat? Cool. Lefty. Okay, anyways, so I'm sorry, it's been at least 10 minutes since I said a bad joke. What's that? Yeah, again, so if it's pejorative and it's taken as pejorative, then it's pejorative. If not, it's not unusual. You know, people do it, but it's, you know, it's best avoided. It's better to avoid it. Why? Why? Because your name, you identify so strongly with your name, right? You could be in a huge room in a crowd, there's noise and everything, and you want people calling. If someone calls your name, your head pops up, right? We identify very strongly with our name. Our name is our connection to ourselves. It's a huge source of our identity. And in fact, Kabbalistically, a person's name, if you understand the deeper meaning of the name and so on, actually is a description of the personality. It says in Kabbalistic works, the Arizal talks about this, that when a child is born and the parents choose a name for the child, there is actually Ruach HaKodesh, there is a divine spirit, so to speak, rests upon the parent in choosing that name. Okay, the idea of taking the name of a loved one and giving it to a departed loved one in Ashkenazic communities. In Sephardic communities, they'll even use a live person. They have juniors in the Sephardic communities. In Ashkenazic, it's not the custom. With permission, okay? With permission, our resident Sephardic scholar is going to make sure I get all my facts straight. The name is such an important part of the identity. It's not just I'm naming this child in memory of my departed grandmother and so on. There is a soul connection, a spiritual connection between the child and the departed person. And in fact, it says you should be careful not to name a child after a person who was wicked. Not just because it's like that person was a terrible person, but because you don't want there to be a connection, a spiritual connection between the child and a less than ideal person. Okay. And that's why a lot of people will name children after great righteous people. Very common. That a parent will not name a child after a departed loved one, but after a very great person who lived previously, who is no longer alive. And the idea of that is also there's a connection, spiritual connection. So if this person was a great tzaddik or tzaddikus, a very righteous man or woman, I'd like that person to be involved and connected to my child. And it carries over. Okay, so that's name. So name is my internal identity. It's how I identify with myself. Language is how I bring my internal self and connect it to someone else. How do I connect to you? I talk to you. Even if I motion or whatever, that's included in language. That's all included in language. Language is the idea of the ability of one person to bring out what's inside and express it to someone else, thereby creating a connection. So language is the second phase. It's taking the internal and bringing it out, connecting it to someone else. Clothing are the most externalized part of my identity, right? Clothes make the man or the woman. What I wear makes an impression, but clothing is the most externalized part of my person, right? So my name is the most internal part. Language, speech is bringing the inside out and connecting. Clothing is the most externalized part of my identity. All three of those things are identity at different levels. It was those three things of identity, internal, connecting inside and outside, that allowed the Jewish people to maintain a connection to the patriarchs while they were in Egypt. And it was their success at maintaining some sort of connection, like Maimonides says, barely. It was almost gone. But there was a little bit left for them to hold on to, that they had to cling on to, that allowed the Jewish people to maintain that connection so that when the time for redemption came, they were able to leave Egypt and go out and rekindle that connection. And then, once they left, as a nation, having maintained that connection to the patriarchs, now I'll come full circle, we go back. They now had to build that connection to the patriarchs, build it step by step, until they came back to the level of spiritual existence that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 tribes had lived at before they went down to Egypt. And that is God actively living, so to speak, manifesting in their midst with a mishkan, with a tabernacle. That was a process. They left Egypt. They had splitting of the sea. They had to come to Sinai and get the Torah. They went through a process of golden calf, which was a big misstep along the way. But then they atoned for that and they repented for that. And God said, okay, we're going to try again. We're going to try again. You were not loyal, but we'll try again. And you'll be able to renew the relationship. And they eventually build the Mishkan. When they build that Mishkan, what they've done is they've fully connected to their forefathers. Because their forefathers, the patriarchs, the tribes, had God living with them, so to speak, in their lives, manifesting clearly. And when the Jewish people build that Mishkan, they have gone from Egypt, where they're barely connected to that tradition, to having built it back up so that God is once again in their midst. They have come full circle back to where they started when they went down to Egypt. But now it's not just roots anymore. Now it's a fully grown, blossomed, flourishing nation of millions of people who now have God in their midst. So that is a little bit about the parasha, about the book of Exodus, about the process of going through Egypt. And that's all I have to say for today. So if there's any final questions, I shouldn't say that. It's not all I have to say, but that's all I'm going to say for today. So if there are any final questions or comments, yeah, Bob, go ahead. What I'm saying is the patriarchs had that connection in their lifetime, and that had to be made a reality for their descendants, for the Jewish people. The Jewish people had to reclaim that connection to God that existed with their forefathers.
So how often do we have to renew that connection?
Right now, we are still waiting. But that connection will ultimately come to fruition with the in the Messianic era. Okay.
What are the questions?
Yeah, hang on one second. So that's what I discussed last week. That the idea of redemption in Judaism is not just physical redemption; it is spiritual redemption. It's reconnecting. You will with again. I'm just still answering this question. I'll take your question in a second.
The answer will make more sense if we know what the question is.
Yes, I'm sorry. He just wants to know when we are going to I apologize. You are correct. He wants to know when we are going to reattain that level of connection today, you know, within ourselves, in our lives. So I'm saying, you know, that is why the arrival of the Messiah is one of the basic tenets of Jewish faith. That's why it's such an important. It's not just like there will be a day of utopia, everyone will be happy. So I mentioned this last week. The deeper idea of the Messianic era is ultimate connection with Hashem, with God. That's the ultimate goal that we are looking for. All right. Okay. Is there any final? Yeah, Bob, go ahead.
So, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of asking, how did we lose it? The connection we had with the patriarch, and I thought we were destined to be a stranger in a strange land.
Right.
For 400 years.
That is correct. Okay, so just to repeat the question, how did the Jewish people lose that connection, and were we not destined to be strangers in a strange land? The answer to both is the answer to the first question is thank you. The answer to the first question is that it was lost because part of the process of exile is losing that connection. Okay, you don't have to go around; it's fine. People will put in if they would like. It's fine. I appreciate it, but thank you. Yeah, I don't want anyone to feel pressure.
Okay, don't feel pressure.
Okay. Thank you. The process of exile is the process of losing that connection. And the challenge of exile is to recognize what you're missing and strive to reconnect. To the extent that we recognize what we are really missing, we can begin the process of reconnection. The challenge is that many people, present company excluded, of course, but many people have a very hard time sensing that loss of connection to God because, especially today in America, life is pretty good. So we don't have that sense of loss. But in a relationship, if you have, you know, two people who are very good friends or in a marriage or so on, if one of them has to leave for whatever reason, for an extended period of time, so one of two things happens. Either the relationship falls away, okay, or they miss each other so much that eventually when they come back together again, that bond is stronger than it was before. One of those two things happens. This was the challenge, and this is always the challenge of exile, is to recognize that there's a relationship that's missing in my life that I should be missing. And the problem is that it's very hard for people to sense that loss, that they're missing that in their life. Now, as far as they were destined, you're right, they were destined to go into exile. But again, the process of exile is ultimately meant to create a stronger, greater relationship, which is a broader discussion I'm not going into now. Go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe one of the reasons they lost that connection is because after you've been beaten down for so long, you're bound to give up hope. And you can apply that to modern times where a number of survivors from the Holocaust just gave up on their religion, you know, whereas others gained more faith because of it.
You are correct. Yes.
But after you've been beaten down for 210 years at least, you know, you're going to say, hey, there is no God. There is no one here.
Yeah, that is, you are absolutely correct. So Jerry is just making the point, and with this we'll end, that some people react to exile and difficulties and to long-term exile by giving up hope. That is true. And some people respond by building their faith further. You're absolutely correct. And that is very much what happened in Egypt. As I mentioned, that a large portion of the Jewish people never made it out of Egypt because they lost that connection, like you said, because they kind of gave up and lost that connection. But the other portion of the Jewish people who did make it out walked out with a unique connection to God because they had managed to maintain that connection. And that, you are correct, that is the challenge of the Jewish people throughout history, is to maintain that connection throughout and not to lose hope. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you all for coming.